Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
And welcome to episode 32 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month, we have a really terrific interview with UK author Andrea Bramall, and you'll hear that great interview in a few moments' time. But before we get to that, we're going to see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as filling you in on what I've been up to over the last month or so, including releasing my brand new book, A Girl Called London. Hooray! Hooray for that. But first up, the Amazon charts. And top of the pops in the US, as I record this, is S.W. Anderson with her novel Switchback. Now, this is her fifth book, and it's about Sierra, a successful mountain bike racer who has it all until she has a catastrophic crash. Charged with putting her back together again is Dr. Cara Davis. That is, if Cara and Sierra can overcome their mutual attraction to each other and focus on getting better, for goodness sake, people. I like the sound of this one. You know, mountain bike racing, that's not an oft-visited topic, so that's very good. It's got rough, it's got tumble, it's got everything in between, so have a look at that one. Also doing well in the UK and US is Jerry Hill's Sawmill Springs. Now, I don't know who does the Jerry's covers, but some of them are just a bit odd, I think, including this one. You know, I'm down with all the geographical ones she does, you know, pictures of sunsets and pictures of the sea and meadows and all that shizzle. But this one looks like a toy town with some police tape around it. But, you know, it's Jerry Hill, so frankly, she can put whatever she wants on her covers because she's a great writer and her books are bankers, aren't they? This one features Detective Mandy Murphy and FBI agent Kayla Dixon. Both are having a rough time at the moment. Mandy with her job and Kayla with her ex. But when they're thrust together on a bloody murder case, their attraction to each other grows. The question is, can they stay alive long enough to act on it? Read the book and find out. In the UK, Kiki Archer's latest, A Fairy Tale of Possibilities, is going great guns, sitting atop the UK chart and troubling the US too for the last couple of weeks. It's the story of wedding planner Lauren, who's been hopelessly in love with her best friend for years, but has never had the courage to tell her. But I think, by the end of the book, Lauren is gonna break her duck and let her know, and then who knows where it might lead. I predict a path to love, because it is a lesbian romance. Reviewers are going mad for this one. It was a big release in June, so check it out. Also doing well in the UK and US is my book, A Girl Called London, so hooray! As I said, I will give you a little rundown of that later on, but thank you so much for buying it. Also popping up in the UK and US as I write this is Harper Bliss's new book, Water Under Bridges. This one is book 5 in the Pink Bean series and features yoga studio owner Louise and coffee shop manager Mia Miller. Now, there's a dark secret from the past that's going to come back and haunt one of our lead protagonists. It sounds intriguing, and I'm sure Harper will pull it off with her usual trademark aplomb and style. Finally, the new one from Nancy Ann Healy, Untold, Alex and Cassidy, book 5, is also burning up the US charts right now. It's a thriller to keep you on the edge of your seat, I'm reliably informed. So if that floats your boat and, you know, thrills and spills are more your bag than romance, Nancy Ann Healy's latest is the one for you. And Giselle Fox's Suncatcher, book 2, is also doing good digital sales, featuring a woman named Taylor and a woman named Jericho. Now, Jericho, that's a new one on me. So character name of the week goes to Giselle Fox for Jericho. And you know what? I think I might make this a new feature of the podcast. Character name of the week. So authors, if you're listening, you could win character name of the week. And what do you win? You win my acclaim. And you know, that's worth so much. Okay, that's the chart roundup for June 2017. We are at the end of June, people. We are halfway through the year. Have you accomplished all your goals? I had a look back on the ones I set in January, and I'm not doing too bad on them, actually. One of the big ones, I've produced two books so far, so that's pretty cool, and my plan is to produce two more. But one of the big ones was to do an audiobook, so and I've got the audio files back from my narrator, so I just need to listen through to that audiobook. I'm putting it off, well, I'm not putting it off at the moment. I've just been busy launching A Girl Called London. And I think I'm excited to hear it, but I'm also frightened to hear it because, you know, it's the first time doing something. But I will get round to that very soon, and hopefully that'll be out sort of by the end of July, beginning of August. So next book club, I should have more news. Anyway, back to June. So a lot went on in June, actually. And first up was the Lambda Literary Awards. And they were held in New York City on June the 12th. And in the Big Apple, the great and good got dolled up for the awards ceremony. And this year's lifetime achievements went to Jeanette Winston and Jacqueline Wilson. And key award winners of note in the lesbian fiction categories were as follows. Best lesbian fiction went to Nicole Dennis-Benn for her novel Here Comes the Sun. So well done to Nicole. Lesbian poetry, best one of that went to Francine J. Harris and Alice Jane Brooks for Play Dead. And also the complete work of Pat Barker were honoured too. Best lesbian mystery went to Jessica L. Webb for her book The Pathogen. And best lesbian memoir went to Dr. Gloria Joseph for The Wind is Spirit, The Life, Love and Legacy of Audre Lorde. And I would definitely put that on my to-be-read list because I'm a big fan of Audre Lorde. And finally, Best Lesbian Romance went to Yoshiyuki Lee for The Scorpion's Empress. So well done to Yoshiyuki. And well done indeed to all the finalists and all the winners. If you'd like to read the full list, it's up at the Lambda Literary website if you want to check that out. As I said earlier, big news for me is that I launched A Girl Called London, so hooray! This is the third book in the London series, following on from London Calling and This London Love. However, like the first two, it's a standalone book, so you don't have to have read the other two at all to enjoy this one. It's a completely new romance between Tanya and Sophie. And Tanya and Sophie are not going to win any Character of the Week name awards, are they? So I really need to up my own game in that one. Anyway, in this one, Tanya is a bit of an ice queen. She was a bit spiky in This London Love as Meg's ex. And she carries that on at the beginning of this one. But she's about to be melted by Sophie London. Yes, she is. A Girl Called London has humour and heart, and it deals with life, love, death, dogs, and the power of unconditional and conditional love. So I hope you read it and enjoy it. And do let me know what you think. And if you do read it, if you take the time to leave a review, just a couple of lines, wherever you bought it, I'd be so appreciative. In fact, that's everybody's homework on this podcast. The last book you read, or maybe even the last two books you read, go and leave a review wherever you bought it, because reviews are really important to authors, and it's the best way to say you enjoyed a book. So don't just leave a review for mine, leave a review for, you know, any book that you've read and you've enjoyed. I was also away for most of June. I went on a long holiday, nearly 3 weeks. My wife and I went to Canada for my nephew's wedding, which was just gorgeous. It was in a vineyard near Niagara. Beautiful venue. The sun shone, the food was great, and literally happiness flowed. It was so beautiful. And then after that, we hung out with my family near Toronto for a week or so. And I also met up, me and my wife met up with author Michelle Tishman. Tishman, I think that's how you say it, and her wife Sonia. Hi, if you're listening, Michelle and Sonia. We went for dinner with them in Toronto, and we had a rare old time. We ate some food and we drank quite a lot of booze, so we all got to know each other. And what we said was one of the weirdest blind dates ever, but it went well. It went well, listener. And then after hanging out in Toronto for like 10 or 11 days, my wife and I went to Chicago for a week. And honestly, I have never seen a gayer city. Never. I know it was Pride Month, but every step you took, there was a Pride flag, a Pride menu, Pride drinks, Pride shoes, Pride t-shirts. I mean, seriously, Chicago is gayer than me, and I'm pretty gay. But we had a fab time, and it's now officially my new favourite US city. Yes, it's overtaken New York, I know, and I really love New York. But it just had such a great vibe to it. It was super liberal, as I said, super gay. Everybody there was so friendly. It was like crazy friendly. And we had great weather and great food and drinks. And the architecture is incredible. And even on the architecture boat tour we took, there was a gay pride flag on the stern of the boat. But we took in a Chicago Sky women's basketball game, which was cool, and they very nearly won, but then they lost at the last minute, so never mind Sky. But I did win a free Chicago Sky t-shirt, so it wasn't a complete loss. We also took in a Chicago Cubs game, which they managed to win, so well done the Cubs. And that was brilliant. And we were also on national TV singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which was unfortunate because that's the only words I know. So they caught me like three lines down, and Yvonne and I were just standing there swaying. So we were on national TV though, so pretty cool. But the city has great food, drinks and architecture, and overall it's a fab venue for the upcoming GCLS conference, which is coming up next month in July, and I'll be bringing you all the news from that on the next podcast. Anyway, that's enough about me and my releases and all the news. Let's get round to the interview with the lovely Andrea Bramall. I hope you enjoy. So joining me today is UK author Andrea Bramall, who is the author of many books, including Clean Slate, Nightingale, Kaleidoscope and Under Par. Her books take in romance and crime, and she's also a Lambda Award winner with Clean Slate. Andrea lives in the Lake District with her partner and dogs. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. It's great to have you here. How are you today?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm hiding out from campers at the moment over on the campsite, so it's all good.
What is hiding out involved? Have you got the curtains closed? Are you squatting down?
No, I have a little office that's kind of an offshoot to the barn building that Louise and I have converted over the last year, and it's as far away from the campsite as I can possibly get, and it's got 2-foot thick walls of old stone buildings, so it's a great place to hide out.
Oh, that is a good place to hide. Is it where you do some of your writing as well?
It's where I do all my writing.
Wow, I can imagine. That's pretty cool. I think every writer listening is going, I want one of those. So my next question was going to be, paint a picture of where you're speaking to us from today, but you've already done that, kind of.
Sorry.
Yeah, but that's good. So like you say, you're running a campsite at the moment, so up in the Lake District.
We do, yes. It's a family business, and this is our second season at this particular campsite. Louise and I previously ran a campsite and hostel down in Norfolk for 8 years before we came up here. So it's not a new venture in that way, but it's a new site up here, which is great fun.
Yeah, and quite a difference, isn't it, going from Norfolk to the Lake District. For people who don't know the geography of the UK, they're about 6 hours apart, aren't they? So, and very different weather conditions, I would imagine.
Very different weather conditions. Norfolk is the driest part of the UK, and Cumbria is the wettest.
Yeah.
But also geographically, Norfolk is completely wide open spaces, you've got great big skies and not a hill as far as the eye can see, and yeah. Up in Cumbria we have nothing but hills and lakes.
Yeah,
so it's beautiful, both inspiring in their own ways.
Yeah, because we did a trip over to Norfolk about sort of 3 or 4 years ago, and I really liked it. We stayed over in Cromer and did all the coast around there, but it is very flat, like you say.
Cromer's about the hilliest part of it, to be fair. Sea cliffs and things like that, but as you go further out towards Lincoln, where we were over at Deepdale, it's honestly there's speed bumps are about as much as you get.
Cool. So tell me a little bit about your writing journey and how you got started.
Writing for me started back in 2000, 2010, I wrote my first novel, Ladyfish, and it was just after Louise and I came back from a holiday in the British Virgin Islands where we'd gone sailing and scuba diving, and I just kind of had this idea of how much fun it would be to write about a romance between a scuba diving instructor and one of the people she was taking diving, and it just kind of started from there. And yeah, I kept making Louise read it and then read a new draft and then another draft, and eventually she got sick of it and said, just send it off to some bugger else. So I did. And it went from there, really. Rad over at Bold Strokes read it and she was happy to sign, and yeah.
I love the fact that you call her Rad there, as people, for people who are not in the know, that is Radcliffe, the very famous lesbian author, right?
Yes, it is.
So she read your first draft initially.
It was Rad who came back to me and said, you know, there are a couple of bits that we'd like you to work on, blah blah, work on these and then come back to us, and I did, and then she sent me a contract through to sign up Ladyfish. So yeah.
That must have been quite exciting because, like you say, she's pretty much the biggest author, would you say, in lesbian fiction?
Definitely up there with two others. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was amazing. Literally at that time, she was probably the author I had the most books on my shelf, which is why I decided to send it to Bold Strokes in the first place.
Right.
And to hear back from her, to get some personal feedback from her, was just like, oh my God, total fan.
Yeah.
Quite really, but yeah, it was great.
Awesome. So that was like 2010, did you say?
It was 2011 by the time I got that back.
Okay.
Yeah, because it was December 2010 when we went on holiday.
Right, okay.
So it was 2011 when that came back, and then it published in 2012.
Right. And as I said in my intro, your books have covered romance, but the latest two, and the one that I read was Kaleidoscope in the lead up for this interview, are crime novels or crime thrillers. There was quite a lot of thrill and chill towards the end of Kaleidoscope, I thought. So what made you switch over from the romance genre to the crime genre for your last couple of releases?
It's not that huge a switch, really. I mean, Ladyfish has some thriller elements to it, and Nightingale very much so, as well as The Chameleon's Tale. So it's not a huge switch. It's just more of a focusing on that as opposed to focusing on the romance element, I suppose. But I do still do the romances. I mean, another one that I released a few months ago was a rom-com. Yeah, put my teeth back in and say that again properly. It was a rom-com. So yeah, I'm one of those people who likes to keep changing things up and write the stories really that appeal to me. And those change. Sometimes they're romances, sometimes they're funny, and sometimes they are scare your pants off. Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I was a little bit scared at the end of Kaleidoscope, but I am easily scared, though, I have to say. I do tend to sort of shy away from crime stuff. But having said that, having done this podcast, I've read Carrie Hunter, and I was going to say Carrie Fisher then, I was thinking, no, that's not right. And Anne Aptica with her Criminal Gold series, which is really good. So I'm getting a little bit more into it. I'm baby steps. So with your Kaleidoscope and your new one, Under Par, they both feature Kate Brannon as the, is she Detective Sergeant, I think?
Yes, there you go. With the CMD over at King's Lynn.
Yeah. And there's some intriguing murders. So tell me a little bit about how you came up for the storylines for those books, since they're based where you used to live.
They are indeed. Kaleidoscope hit me while I was out walking the dogs, actually. There is the North Norfolk Coastal Path, which used to go from literally across the road where the campsite was that we used to work at. And I was out there, and it was kind of really early in the morning, and there was some people just shooting, they were hunting rabbits, I think, or scaring birds off or whatever, and it just kind of hit me how kind of easy it would be for someone to be in a lot of danger out there without knowing it. And from that one kind of tiny little thought, this whole idea started to blossom, and I was stood by the dike where the seawater came in and flooded the fields, and it just struck me as this kind of perfect position for a body to be found. And it just kind of rolled from there, really.
Right.
The idea of using the campsite owner as being the victim just, I suppose, was my own little joke to myself.
I did laugh, because it's no spoiler by saying that she does die, but I did laugh when that happened. I thought,
yeah, there was something really kind of cathartic about figuring out who in the village would kind of want to murder me, I suppose.
Yeah. Is that why you moved recently?
Yeah.
And I loved your description, like the opening scene of Kaleidoscope is terrific. I really did love all the descriptive passages of that. It really put you in the area, so big well done for that. And the character of Kate as well, I loved her backstory. It was very sad and really piqued my interest. So tell me a little bit about the process of coming up with her, or just how you make your characters feel so real.
Because they are so real to me. Now, this is where I start sounding like a complete schizophrenic or something like that, but each of the characters, I kind of, this sounds really, really freaky, and it really, they are real to me. I kind of, my process, I become them for a little while.
Okay.
Louise says it's weird. It's like I stop being me, and she's living with someone else for a few weeks, and then I go back to being me again. So, yeah, it's quite weird, but they are real to me. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, no, totally. But you kind of, it's kind of like method writing, is it? Like method acting?
Very much so, yeah. I usually plan out my books really well in advance, so I know how I want the scenes to go, particularly when the thrillers and the murder mysteries and things like that. So I know where all the red herrings are going, where the leads are, where the bits of evidence are and things like that. So by the time I actually start writing, it only takes me a really short time to write the first draft, usually about 3 weeks for the first draft. So for those 3 weeks, I'm just totally immersed in it. And as I say, I become the characters for a little bit. And then once I write the end, I go back to being me again.
Right. Okay. That's really, yeah, that's really cool. 3 weeks to write a first draft, that's very quick. But I guess you do, it's all in the planning, right?
Yeah, the planning can take me weeks, sometimes months before it's ready to fall out. I have these whiteboards over my office where I've got storylines in different stages of planning at the moment. So, like, the next book for the Norfolk Coast series, I've got three of those on the go with an overarching storyline that's going through the three of them, and then I've got two other sort of standalones that I've got they're at different stages of planning. So once one of them's ready, then I'll sit down and write that, probably come September, and it'll fall out in a few weeks.
I like the way you say fall out. It's like it just happens magically.
it sort of does. It's more like kind of it's not a conscious thing. I don't think about every word and everything like that. I just let it kind of vomit out almost, first draft, and then go back and fix it later.
Okay. So is your whiteboard very big, or have you got more than one? Because you said like you're planning like 3, 4, 5 books at a time.
I've got multiple whiteboards, and I've got cord boards as well all over my office with different ideas pinned on them and scribbled out all over the place. So, yeah, I have multiple.
So you have multiple personalities at many different times.
Yes.
So in Kaleidoscope, as I alluded to at the beginning, that there are some quite, for me anyway, quite sort of, very tense and slightly grisly scenes towards the end. And I was reading through my fingers a little bit. And I was just wondering as well, how about tapping into the darker side of life? How do you, does that come quite easily? Or is that something you've had to really research?
Quite easily, and that's really going to scare a lot of people. I think for me it's a great way of getting out all those frustrations and sort of playing with the there are things that really piss you off, and in a way you can kind of really go to town with that in a very safe way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost therapy, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I know this does sound really scary, but it's every character that I create has an aspect of me in them taken to the nth degree. So I can take something that I would like to say but would never have the guts to, and I can put it in the book and I can run with it. But there are so many aspects of that darkness that I like to, it's not play with as such, but it's kind of exercise, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are or have been many sort of dark periods through my life that I can almost use cathartically when I write. I'm someone who suffered from many years with depression and self-harming and various other issues like that. So I can take those kind of dark aspects of myself and almost, as I say, kind of purge myself in the books, if you like.
Mm-hmm. No, well, it's quite a common thing, isn't it, that writing is quite therapeutic in that way. And I've heard a lot of... I've heard it said many times that horror writers are some of the most calm and lovely people because they get it all out on the page. It's those romance writers you've got to watch out for, you know.
Oh, they're a dark bunch, them lot.
They're very dark in real life. and just going back to Kaleidoscope as well with the cover. You shot the cover, and your character Connie, who gets killed, is into photography, and you are as well. So is that something we can expect more of as well in the future?
Under Par is also the cover for that is also another photo I've taken, and the next one that's coming up in the series, The Last First Time, that's also a photograph I've taken. So it is the plan to take the photographs for each of the covers for this particular series. So.
Which also must be quite, a sense of achievement as well, having that on
very
the cover.
Much so. It's a very different feeling holding a book that's got your own image, if you like, on the cover.
Yeah.
Kind of took me back to that first feeling of holding Ladyfish in my hands and seeing my name on the cover for the first time, and it's the same kind of feelings, knowing how much input I had into that cover, so it was great.
I hope your publisher's paying you for them.
You must remember
to do that. So switching to your romance novels, which they definitely are romance, but they're quite sort of meaty. I'm getting the gist of that. And there's a lot of diversity in them, which is something I spoke about with your fellow Ilva author, G. Benson. Nightingales focuses on a young Muslim woman who's in line for an arranged marriage. And The Chameleon centres on a relationship between two girls in apartheid South Africa. What made you write both of those? Because they're very different from what normally happens in lesbian romance.
They are. The Chameleon's Tale, and I actually lived in South Africa as a child. We moved there when I was about 5 years old, and we came back when I was about 10. So I was a part of the apartheid regime, and that is something else that's affected me, and when I look through my work, I can see the strains of that very much in different storylines and things, sort of the oppression of people and those with power utilising it, and not always for very good means. But it took me a long time to kind of figure out how to deal with those feelings of being an unwitting part of such a regime. And The Chameleon's Tale was, in a way, my exploration of that. Again, this sounds like it's very dark. It's not. These are things that I see when I look back at it, as opposed to what I'm thinking of when I'm actually writing the stories, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The biracial aspect of the story is something that's always appealed to me, because it is something that we don't see too much of. It's growing within lesbian romance, but it's not a big aspect of it, and part of the reason why I like to be a part of lesbian fiction is to see representation, to see ourselves on the page. And if there isn't that representation, then I think that we're failing people within our own community. So that's kind of why I try to tackle it as much as I can. There are limits to what I can do, because I don't feel that I should tackle something if I don't feel I can do it justice. The storyline within Nightingale with the Muslim story, that was actually an idea I'd had 8 years before I started to write it, but I wasn't in a place either emotionally or with the knowledge that I had where I was able to do the story justice that it needed. And that is such a powerful story and such a relevant one at the moment that it needed to be done right rather than just done.
Definitely, yeah. When I was reading about that, I put it on my to-be-read list because, yeah, it sounds very interesting. And I was thinking maybe it would have come to fruition earlier had you had your whiteboard office, but, you know, everything comes at the right time, really.
Yeah, I think it was more a case of that, to be honest. And emotionally, I mean, Nightingale took me 3 months to write because it was so emotionally draining, and I would stop writing every night and I'd be in tears because it's so it pulled everything out of me writing that. And I have to say, Claire, if you read Kaleidoscope Through Your Fingers, probably wait on Nightingale.
Okay. I can't help it. I'm a fluffy romance kind of girl, and but I am pushing myself out. It's 2017 is my year of reading more diversely. I've been doing that outside lesfic anyway. But I'm going to try and do it in lesfic too. So I will give it a go. I will.
Do yourself warm then.
Yeah.
That's the one that just it would not leave me alone until I wrote it.
Okay. And what sort of feedback have you been getting from readers on these? On Nightingale and
Nightingale in particular, I've had amazing feedback. I've had emails from a couple of Muslim women who have been in not the same situation, thankfully, but in situations where they've had to make the choice between their own happiness and their family, their culture, their faith, and they've had points where they could have gone either way. And they said that seeing a realistic interpretation of their struggle helped them immensely. And in all honesty, that's as much as I could ever hope for.
No, I mean, that's very powerful feedback. So, yeah, that must give you, like, real sort of make you very satisfied that you eventually worked out how to go about the project and did it very well. So that's really cool.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I when I do get around to reading it, I'm sure I'm going to need a box of tissues, right?
Maybe two.
Yeah. And another interesting romance you penned was Clean Slate, which won the Lambda Literary Award for Best Romance in a year that is recent. I'm sure you can fill me in. And this one is about Morgan, whose marriage to Erin is over, but then she's attacked and loses her memory, and they have to piece back their lives together. So tell me about the inspiration for writing this, because, again, it sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, there were two things that kind of inspired this one, to be honest, and from two different sides. My grandfather, just before I started writing it, or just before I came up with the idea, had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And the way we were trying to come to terms with that as a family and everything that we were feeling, that's very much how I explored it, very much through Erin and the children's stories within Clean Slate.
Mm-hmm.
How they dealt with losing Morgan, how they dealt with finding her again and getting to know her as a completely different person, how they dealt with the grief of losing the Morgan that they'd known. All of those things were aspects that I look back on now and realise that I was exploring. The other side of it, the side that was actually Morgan's, again, this goes back to my own struggles with mental health issues, but I had a breakdown in 2009, and there is a 10-day period of my life that I have no memory of whatsoever. None at all. I took myself off to somewhere and I didn't want to go home, and then all I know is that 10 days later the police found me in Newcastle, which was completely the other side of the country, and I have no idea how I got there. I was living in a flat in a shared house, and I got myself a job, I was going by a different name, and I have no recollection whatsoever.
Goodness, wow.
And Clean Slate, now looking back again, not at the time, it wasn't something I was conscious of at the time, but looking back now, that was my, within Morgan, I was dealing with how I felt guilty about the things, about what happened, and how I was trying to come to terms with the person that I was and wasn't, and yeah, it was all a mess.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, that's incredible, because, but that's an amazing thing to try to achieve, like put, I guess, looking into the reasons behind your, why what happened to you happened to you, and then putting yourself on the page like that, like bearing yourself on the page, is quite incredible.
Again, as I can say, it's not something that I was conscious of at the time, and probably wasn't till maybe a year or two after, even. But yeah, that's definitely where all those emotions came from, and where the confusion that's in Morgan comes from.
Yeah.
And it was, again, a very cathartic experience, and it's helped me deal with a lot of my own issues, if you like.
Mm-hmm. So you're just adding to my TB Red here, Andrea. I mean, goodness gracious me. And obviously, as I said, that one won an award. So what did you do when you found out you'd won an award?
Well, it was... the ceremony was over in New York, so it's stupid o'clock in the morning when I got a buzz through on my phone saying this had happened, and it was like, what, huh? Looking through kind of very slitted eyes, trying to actually make it out at, I think it was about 3 a.m. or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of smacked Louise on the head and said, does that say I've won? And she went, yeah, well done. And I went back to sleep. Not really until sort of a couple of days later when it really sort of dawned on me what had happened. And then I still didn't believe it until the award actually arrived, which was actually about 4 or 5 months later. And then it was like, oh my God, I won! Yeah! Running around the house a little bit with stupid dancing involved.
You know, I think that
it's like you've got to do.
I would encourage stupid dancing at that moment, for sure. So is it in your office, this award somewhere?
It is. It's over on the windowsill at the moment with the light shining through.
Lovely.
It looks very pretty. It's all glass and, yeah, it looks very pretty.
Cool. And so you've kind of already described a little bit about your writing process. You're very much a planner, and then you sort of get the first draft down. And what happens after that?
Then it's revise, edit, revise, edit. Revise, edit. I sound like a frog. I go through multiple stages of revisions and edits. Then it goes to beta readers, comes back, goes another stage of revisions and edits before I even think about sending it off to my editors. Then it goes through another 3 or 4 rounds of edits before it's ready for print interiors to be made up and proofreading and all the other good stuff that goes through. For me, the writing process is so quick that I feel that I definitely have to spend as much time as possible going through it and revising it and making it as good as it can be, rather than just what kind of falls out of my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first draft is just telling yourself the story, as somebody famous once said.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So
then you've got to make it decent for other people to have a look at.
Yeah. Don't forget that bit. So what sort of length of time are you generally that take then from the time you put your first you put your fingers on the keyboard? I'm assuming you use a keyboard. Until you get it out to the public.
From when the first draft is finished, it then takes me probably 6 to 8 weeks to get it ready for going to the publisher. And then the publishing process can take anywhere from 6 months to 12 months, depending on when I'm looking at publication deadlines. I tend to write mostly over the winter so that I'm free the summer over the campsite. I do editing stuff over the summer, but I don't actually write from sort of now through till September.
Oh, okay, so is your campsite only open for certain months of the year then?
It opens from March through to October, but the busiest periods are sort of from the second May bank holiday through to the end of August.
So you're just entering into it all then now?
Oh yes, it's just kicking off.
Get your wellies on, because you're in the Lake District now. There'll be lots of rain.
Do you know, we've had sunshine then. Huh? We've had rain today, but up until then, we've had loads and loads of sunshine. It's been unbelievable. That could be summer over with.
Yeah, yeah. hold on to some piece of wood near you.
So
how has your writing process changed, would you say, over time? Because as you said, you've been writing now for 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm. Lady Fish was very much I sat down and just started writing and just let whatever fell out fall out. It was not planned in any way, shape or form. It just happened. Just had the idea for the characters and the setting and just went with it. After that, I was going through a workshop with some of the other Bold Strokes authors that Rad was running, and she was sort of asking for ideas on different things and blah blah, and one of the exercises, and with that exercise I came up with the idea for Clean Slate. So I sort of posited it to her, and she said, right, write me a synopsis, give me a breakdown of the chapters. And before I know it, I had a plan for every single chapter that I wanted to write in that book. So I thought, oh, this is a good idea. This is a great way to write.
Yeah.
Because literally then once I had that, it took 3 weeks to write, whereas Ladyfish took maybe 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, if I can make everything so much quicker, then I can write more stories. So I just kind of adopted that. And then from there, I started going to sort of post-it notes that I'd stick up on the wall in my old office. And then it adapted from there again. To now having my big whiteboards everywhere. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it slowly has evolved into this very much plotted style. The rom-coms and the true romances have a bit more freedom, but with the murder mysteries and the thrillers, I need to have those really well placed out so that I get everything in that needs to go in.
Yeah, I always imagine you need to know where your twists and turns are going to come much in there.
And very much so, especially with the sort of the Norfolk Coast series, where I've got storylines arcing over multiple books.
Mm-hmm.
If you miss something in an early book that you need later, you're kind of screwed if you've forgotten it.
Yeah. It was in my head, damn it. And so now you've been writing for quite a while. You're almost a veteran of lesbian fiction world now. So what's your favourite thing about writing, and what's your least favourite, would you say?
My favourite thing is just being able to create, being able to sort of sit there in front of my computer and write down all those words that bug me and all those things that I love and all those things that I want to see on the page that I haven't seen somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really love, just creating. What do I hate about it? It's not so much hate, but what I found the most difficult is the publicity side of it, of trying to find people to bug them about reading your stories and going out there and buying it. And I find that really quite difficult. I suppose I'm the stereotypical writer, if you like. I'm very much an introvert and I'm fine on my own. Not so great with people all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a common trend with writers. I think most people would like to be shut in their cave, but we've got to go out and put it out there. And
so people. That's what I found most difficult. Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. And are you an avid reader? Can't get my words. Are you an avid reader of lesbian fiction yourself?
I am. Yes. I don't tend to read I can't read new works while I'm writing my own stories, but during the summer and when I'm just editing the stories I've written, yeah, I read all the time. I can go through a book a day or something like that if I've got the time.
A book a day? Wow, you're a fast reader and a fast writer.
I'm sure that's always a good thing.
I know, it's like I've got a friend and she's such a fast reader. I remember she woke up early one day when she was staying at our house, and I said to her, oh, there's like a shelf full of books downstairs, just pick one up. And she read two before we woke up. So and we're not even that late risers. But
wow.
Yeah,
that's fast.
I'm not sure how much she took in. I think one of them was Take That biography, though, so I'm not sure how many great words Gary Barlow had to impart for her, but you know.
Well, yeah. Skip read, probably.
Yeah. Or Barry Gallo, as I like to call him. And what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given, would you say?
wasn't so much a piece of writing advice. It was more almost life advice, but it came to me when I read my first negative review. That was a poignant moment, and it was from my granddad, actually. It was, he said, "Just remember our Andrea." That's how he spoke.
Yeah.
"Just remember our Andrea. You're never as good as anyone's ever going to tell you you are, but you're never as bad either." And that really stuck with me, and it very much helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great bit of advice. Well done, Grandad. Cool. And what's next for you?
At the moment, I have I've just written a story called Rock and a Hard Place, which will come out in October. And I'm working on the next instalment of the Norfolk Coast series, which will be the last first time. That's due out in December, I believe.
Okay.
And that follows on with Kate and Gina and some more dastardly deeds on the North Norfolk Coast.
I hope there's going to be a happy ending, because I'll be upset otherwise. And you don't want me upset, do you? So you might have to rearrange your arc.
How do I do this without giving away so much? There will be happy endings, but there'll be some stuff that you won't like too.
I imagine that will be the case. But I'll brace myself. Brace. Maybe I'll have to read it by a pool, so I've got like all the other things balancing out the negativity. I remember I did that with The Kite Runner. I read that by a pool, and that was a good thing to do, because that was a very emotional book. Yeah, I know. It's like, I think I went on holiday with five, me and my partner and four of our friends, and we all read it that week. And every single one of us was like crying around the pool every day. So yeah, that was interesting. And final question for you. If you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
Ooh, interesting. I would go with Douglas Adams of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
mm-hmm.
and Jeanette Winterson. reasons why. Okay. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the very, very inaccurately named trilogy of five books, was a series of books that I started reading when I was about 17, and they were awesome, just what I needed at the time. I mean, the guy created a suicide robot, for God's sake. That's just awesome. And I think sort of growing up with that kind of imagination within the vicinity possibly would have brought out a bit more of my creativity earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeanette Winterson was the first writer, lesbian writer, that I discovered when I was at university. And yeah, she's just awesome.
She is. She is. I think that would be a pretty cosmic matchup. So
yeah.
I think those.
Never gonna happen, but you know.
Yeah. No, it's never going to happen. But you know, it's good to sort of think about these things and then discard them. It'd be interesting growing up with Jeanette Winston, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
Yeah. And where can people find out more about you, Andrea?
I have a website, and obviously through Ilva's website as well, but also there's plenty of stuff on Facebook if you want to friend me, and my Facebook handle is Andrea Bramhall.
What's your website?
It is Andrea Bramhall at wordpress.co.uk.
Cool, okay.
Oh, .com, isn't it? .com, sorry.
.com. I'm sure if you just put Andrea Bramhall in Google, people can find things, can't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time, Andrea. You've been a star, and it's been fantastic.
Thank you very much for having me, Claire. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you. That's the end of this lesbian book club. So this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy dipping into any of my books, my brand new release, A Girl Called London, any of the other London series, the All I Want series, Nothing to Lose, or The Long Weekend, you can find out more at www.clairelydon.co.uk
or just look me up at Amazon, Kobo, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, Bella Books, or any of the other digital outlets. I'm also on Twitter, at Claire Lydon, so come on down and follow me there. I'm also on Facebook, claire.lydon, and I'm on Instagram, at ClaireFic. Thanks to Denise at My Lesbian Radio for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And join me next time for more hot book club action, where I'll be interviewing the lovely Rosie Wilby. See you then.